The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
What a day, what a day, what a day. We'll share that with you this evening and look forward to you sharing your thoughts of today's big money stories, including Jacob Zuma being told once again, doesn't get the message the first time, so got to repeat it, I suppose. Pay back the money, this time to VBS. Remember, Vendor Building Society, who lent him the money he needed in order to settle the first pay back the money. That was absolutely pivotal, of course, in the report that Thuli Madonsela filed in the weeks before she departed the venerable, once venerable, office of the public protector. So we'll talk about that this evening. We'll catch up with Polly van Wyk all about that. Also this evening, we'll also talk to Lord Peter Hain. He is in the United Kingdom. Of course, he is an anti-apartheid campaigner. He has also been instrumental in drawing attention to the vagaries of South Africa's criminal justice system. And I'm looking for his reaction tonight to just the sudden apparent success and the clampdowns that we've seen in the face of the issues around the appearance of the translate accused, Enoj Singh and Brian Molefe, yesterday in court as the doors of the Saxon World Shabin slammed shut once and for all, of course. Ian Williamson, Chief Executive at Old Mutual, with us in just a bit. Also tonight, the future of banking in a way that perhaps you haven't considered it. And things are changing so, so fast. We'll pick up on that this evening. We'll do our investment school. And, of course, heroes and zeros from the world of advertising. Brendan Seery helping us out tonight.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Well, remember when Jacob Zuma was ordered to pay back the money? He took out a loan with VBS Mutual Bank, an institution few had heard about outside of the old Vendor region. Well, it turned out to be a disaster for a number of municipal pension funds and other depositors when it emerged it was at the centre of a massive fraud. Anyway, today, the curators of VBS can now claim back more than 6.5 million rand still outstanding from Jacob Zuma, who stopped paying his instalments on his loan soon after it was put under curatorship. On that story is Polly van Wyk, the journalist with Scorpio and Daily Maverick. When did he start defaulting on this loan, Polly?
Good afternoon, Bruce. So he defaulted on the loan for the first time in around August 2018, which is, if one looks at the timeline, a few months after he stepped down as president, and a few months, almost the same length, as the VBS Mutual Bank was put into curatorship. So it was very clear that President Jacob Zuma's patronage network and his power was quite connected.
Well, we make that assumption, or is there any documentary evidence to suggest, terribly sorry, I've lost my friends, the Guptas, they've vanished, the Saxon World Shabin is closed, my cash flow has been encumbered, therefore, terribly sorry, I can't pay back the loan, or did he just not pay?
Yeah, all circumstantial evidence. He was given that loan on really good terms, more than anyone around us would receive from a bank. And then the huge question here is that he didn't earn the loan in terms of his salary. He couldn't really repay it on what he earned per year. So there was clearly someone footing the bill for him.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, who would give a 76-year-old, though we're not being ageist here, but a 76-year-old with limited job prospects, he was coming to the end of his term in office as a politician. He would then be on limited funds as a pensioner, and a well-paid pensioner at that, but no ways that anybody in their right mind would lend a person under those sort of circumstances without surety that amount of money. It was about 9 million rand or something at the time. He took out that loan, of course, to cover the money that Thuli Madonsela calculated he owned on the non-security upgrades in Nkandla. Now, if it was you or me who owed the money and we hadn't paid it back, the bank or its curators would simply come back and take our property away from us, take our cars away from us. But here's the problem. Nkandla is built on a farm called the Nkomalala Farm, and it's owned by the Ingonyama Trust. So, you know, the ownership of the property that you and I paid for as taxpayers is kind of in that flux, of course, and that great uncertainty.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good summary. So all other monetizable assets will be taken, according to the curator. And he's done really well, Anuj Rupal, the curator of VBS, to take money back from all sorts of quarters where it's owed to VBS Mutual Bank. And in this instance, perhaps he will start looking more widely to which other assets he can grab relating to Mr. Zuma. Well, at the moment, we'll have to see first if he can get to Nkandla.
Absolutely. And you know, also, again, what are the movable assets at Nkandla that can be attached and whether or not anybody will stand in his way, of course, because we've seen those theatrics in the past too. And what's how interested the state is going to be in ensuring that the VBS curator is able to do their job. Any sort of statement of support at all for today's judgment and the actions that the curator is going to have to take?
No. So obviously someone should be appointed to go and grab the assets, yep. And that process is still is still underway. And further, we haven't seen the actual order yet, so we don't know whether it's a wide-ranging order and what the judge said about other assets. But the spokesperson for Rupal already confirmed that at least the first judgment has been received and that they will take steps to commit to that order.
There's a queue, though, isn't there, for assets related to Jacob Zuma? Karen Morn pointing out today that today's order is on top of an 18.2 million rand recovery related to the unlawful use of public funds during his corruption trial defence. And because there is just so much noise and so many orders and so many counter orders and so much chaos in the legal processes around Jacob Zuma, it's very hard to keep track. But you guys are doing a fine job of doing so. There's, you know, there can't, you know, be that much money lying around, can there, in terms of these various orders that have been handed down against Jacob Zuma?
Yeah, it's a good question. We simply don't know. On the one hand, we suspect a lot of money swirling around because Marianne Tam, my Daily Maverick colleague, has previously written about a huge property that's been turned into a guest house that's linked to Mr. Zuma's ownership. So that's on the one hand. And there has been talk today from sources that there may be other properties as well. On the other hand, we don't, just don't know if everything has just been lived out in a hand-to-mouth kind of way. So it's definitely something that journalists will look into. But I also think that the prosecuting authority may start getting closer to perhaps prosecute some other crimes where they can find money flowing directly to our president.
When former president, yeah, the current president has also got some questions
the
around money.
Perhaps as well.
When is Jacob Zuma due back in court on the corruption trial? Because that sort of was making great progress, and then of course that stuttered and stumbled as well.
Yes, so you're talking obviously about the arms deal. Yep. I'm not sure about that recurring court date. I'm actually referring hopefully to new court cases, especially relating to the latest Transnet arrests. And then we know that there were several other cases where the president may have been involved in relating to specifically his Gupta friends.
Yeah, so there's a huge amount of stuff going on. How are your sources at the National Prosecuting Authority feeling about the sudden burst of progress that appears to be happening in these cases? I mean, yes, it blows hot and cold, and we get three steps forward, two steps back very often when it comes to Jacob Zuma. But is there a deal of confidence in the air at the NPA?
I find a deal of confidence in the investigative directorate, definitely, sir. I do, however, see that there's some frustration with some of the units. The other unit inside the prosecuting authority, where especially the commercial crime units aren't necessarily seeming to do what they should do. The ID, we all know, can not only do so much. It's a smallish unit, and they're headed by Advocate Andrea Johnson, and they've done good work. The latest Transnet arrests have come under them. But what are the specialized commercial crimes units doing? Where are the cases against, for example, ANC bigwigs like Ace Magashule or any of the other people? So I definitely pick up some frustration between colleagues there.
And then another big story that you've been working on, the suspension of two senior staff from Sasfin following SARS clamping down, of course, on gold leaf cigarettes. That was the big story yesterday, a court order on unpaid taxes from that particular company. And what is Sasfin's role or its employees' roles believed to have been here?
Yeah, that is a massive story, and I think in my mind it definitely eclipses the current Zuma drama. So what happened in essence is that five Sasfin officials were corrupted into helping Simon Rutland and a massive transnational plunder network to move more than 3 billion rand in illicit cigarette cash between the years of 2016 and 2017 out of the country to jurisdictions like Dubai and Mauritius and Switzerland without any taxes being paid and without the Reserve Bank being alerted of Forex movements. So anyone who works with Forex movements and listening will know about the BOPCUS reports that's going to the Reserve Bank daily, and those were deleted. Now, our listeners who's aware of these money flows and how it works will know how very, very serious this is. And it's definitely something that we haven't seen in South Africa ever, that banking officials started deleting banking transactions.
What do we know about the actions Sasfin has taken to date in terms of the way in which its staff are alleged to have behaved?
I'm trying to make sense of that. And at the moment, there's Michael Sassoon, the CEO of Sasfin, stated that after I spoke to him on Friday last week, past Friday, they thought about the matter, they spoke to each other inside Sasfin, and apparently yesterday morning, two people, the last two people who were still working at Sasfin, were precautionary suspended. Now, on Michael's version, they only got to know who these people were and that they were evidence against them of wrongdoing when SARS published their court order, and when I started working on it. On SARS's version, there's a hell of a lot of information available, and they feel that these people are very corrupt.
Polly van Wyk, journalist at Scorpio and Daily Maverick, listening to that. Michael Sassoon at Sasfin, he's the chief executive. When did you become aware of the fact that you were being used as a money laundering operation, Michael? Good evening.
Good evening, Bruce. Thanks for having me on the show. Good evening to your listeners. SARS commissioned an inquiry in terms of the Income Tax Act in about March of this year, where they subpoenaed a number of our staff and started accessing information relating back to transactions in 2017. As part of that process, we immediately independently commissioned our own independent investigations into some of the allegations. We were not privy to everything that SARS did, because SARS obviously have a much wider scope in terms of search and seizure. And SARS issued a press statement on Friday that they had they were successful in the action. We haven't yet seen the SARS case files, which I believe that Pauly is in possession of. And therefore, we don't have the same amount of information that even Pauly has, because she was able to access those case files at some point prior to the press release, I would imagine.
But this stuff, Michael, goes back to 2016, 2017. I mean, this is stuff for the history books. This is, 6 years ago, at least, yeah, in terms of the events that occurred. At the time, people were dismissed, is my understanding. Please just bring me up to speed. You were aware of this long before before March 2022. There was an awareness within Sasfin that something had gone down around about the time it went down, wasn't there?
No, there was no knowledge at 2017 of any collusion or any kind of fraudulent behavior by any of our staff. We closed the accounts of Gold Leaf in 2017 because we saw suspicious transactions of, taking money out of the country, which concerned us. Those reports were all submitted to the relevant authorities in 2017. But at that point, and up until SARS initiated their inquiry earlier this year, we were not in possession of any information which implicated any of our any allegations even against any of our people until earlier this year. We have taken labor law advice on it, and all the information that we had gathered on our people did not result in actionable evidence to dismiss anyone. There is suspicion, and based on the information that Paulie alludes to on in the SARS case files, there appears to be far more reason to be suspicious, and on the back of that, we thought it was appropriate to suspend pending the full outcome of our investigation.
What does this tell you, though, about your own internal audit processes, the role of your external auditors, the fact that this amount of money could be laundered through your systems, go to Dubai, Mauritius and into Switzerland, not pay the taxes, not alert the Reserve Bank, yet you didn't find reason to sanction your staff on that basis in 2017 and only recently, as of Friday, suspend two staff? There seems to be a great big missing piece of the puzzle here, Michael.
Yeah, so I understand, obviously it's horrific to learn of these facts today in the last few months. I can say that we have, for separate reasons, but we have changed the foreign exchange systems. The other point which is important to note is we were never Gold Leaf's primary banker. So all income that was earned by Gold Leaf did not hit their primary bank account at Sasfin. That would have been with other banks. And I do not believe that we were doing the full foreign exchange for Gold Leaf either. And the numbers that Paulie quotes of $3 billion, and as I say, I haven't seen the SARS case files are above what our records, we've been able to gather through our records. But in terms of our internal control environment, we have significantly over the years, as regulation has become tighter and given this very difficult operating environment that we're in, where there's much corruption, we have significantly enhanced our controls over the last few years. And I can give you many examples of that, but we've built our reputation over so many years. Mm.
Do you dispute the numbers? I mean, do you dispute the numbers here, Michael? I mean, Poli's assertion is as much as 3 billion rand could have been siphoned through Sasfin and into accounts in different countries. Do you dispute that number? Do you dispute the broad tenets of the story?
No, I think that there are, from what I've gathered from what Poli shared, there does seem to be some credence, but the number of 3 billion rand that went through Sasfin, I have not seen anything to support that number. That's still a very meaningful number that went through Sasfin, so I'm not...
I mean, you guys aren't a huge bank. I mean, you would have noticed 3 billion rand flowing through your coffers, wouldn't you?
Well, over a two-year period, we do a couple billion rand of foreign exchange on a monthly basis, and I don't know exactly what it was in those days.
Sure.
So over a two-year period, our number's below 2 billion rand, so it would have been maybe 3% of our foreign exchange trade, and our 5% of our foreign exchange trade at the time, and our foreign exchange business makes up less than 7% of the income of the total organization.
But something went horribly wrong. At some point here, Michael, something went horribly wrong. And unfortunately, you're going to have to deal with the consequences of that now. One wonders whether or not Sasfin can survive this. Do you think it will?
Yeah, I'm very confident we will survive this. We have a very strong capital and liquidity position. Mm-hmm. We have got a very long-standing, deep relationships with our clients. Something did go wrong here. And it's terrible that this... these individuals, these rogue elements, can cause so much damage. We are taking we take this very significantly. It's very concerning, given our complete commitment to stamping out any form of corruption and fraud, and and our commitment to good ethics. But based on our long track record, our long history with our clients, our strong balance sheet, which we've always had, I'm very confident that we will emerge stronger from this, as difficult as it is at the moment.
Would you, the people you've suspended, would you say they were friends? Would you say they were remote colleagues? Are these people part of your inner circle at Sasfin?
Not at all. These were individuals who were relatively junior officials. There was one relatively senior compliance official, believe it or not, who I have no relationship with other than through the banking network. It's not our head of compliance, it was something more junior than that.
Michael Sassoon, thank you very much indeed. The chief executive at SASFIN. When things go bad, they go bad very, very badly and on a very significant fashion. Polly van Wyk, fantastic story, pulling that one together. And you heard also from Michael Sassoon, the chief executive at SASFIN.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
On to markets, which read like a similar sort of horror story since Friday when Jerome Powell, Wayne McCurry from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank, drove home the very stark warnings about inflation and the need to deal with it with higher interest rates. Markets have been in a bit of a panic once again.
Yes, and I mean, it's quite clear, Bruce. He reconfirmed what I've always actually known about the Fed. Inflation is enemy number one. Everything else is subsidiary to that. If necessary, they'll push the economy into a recession. If necessary, they'll keep them higher for longer. They are going to tame inflation. They learned the lesson in the 70s of what inflation can do, and they're never going to let it get out of control like it did then.
And, I mean, what's your sense of it? I mean, lots of people have been saying for probably the last 6 to 8 months, the Fed's behind the curve, the Fed's behind the curve, the Fed has been calling inflation transitory, and suddenly they seem to be waking up to the reality that many in the markets have been talking to for a long time.
Correct. And they were behind the curve, but make no mistake, inflation's rolling over rapidly. Oil price, we know, gets below 100 again today, but food prices are falling quite dramatically. And the economy will slow, which will take all the heat out of the labor market. So inflation is going to fall rapidly, I don't know, second half of next year, but, you know, in the not too distant future. And despite all the sayings to the contrary and all the opinions to the contrary, interest rates will probably start to fall again in the second half, maybe the last quarter of next year. This inflation, I mean, other than the labor component, is not related to demand. It's related to external factors, the COVID, the Russian war, all of these other factors. But most importantly, food and oil look to me as though they're rolling over, and other commodity prices, copper's rolling over, they're all rolling over. So we probably have seen the peak of inflation. In a slowing economy, inflation's not going to rear its head again, and we'll see the numbers come down. But of course, they've got to come down a very long way.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest concerns of the Fed is inflation expectations. I mean, if inflation, if they don't sort of really put a lid on it, or more correctly, knock it on its head, you know, the next time you ask for a salary increase or a wage increase, you say, look at the inflation rate. I'm entitled to that. Because it's your expectation that is going to stay higher. The moment you crush that expectation, you know, then inflation actually comes down very, very quickly.
Talk to me about why we're talking about rollovers. Old Mutual rolled over quite significantly today. The results showing substantial growth. Yet the market took one look at those Old Mutual results and sent the share price down very, very sharply.
Very, very sharply. Now, surprisingly enough, we were expecting much better results from Old Mutual. Earnings were down 7%. I mean, their adjusted earnings were actually down. You know, when you look at their gross revenue, their gross premiums written was down. You know, their client cash flows were down almost 30%. The value of new business, which is essentially like how much they actually sold, that's down. That's negative 4%. Funds under management are down 7%. You know, it's not actually a good set of results here. So, I mean, and that's why the market punished them. But, you know, maybe now is the time to actually go out and buy the share, because, you know, this thing's very cheaply rated. I mean, especially after today's fall, you're buying it at a 6% dividend yield, which is, I think, very good long-term value. And when you look at the share, going back in a bit of history, I mean, it's done nothing since 2020. It's basically almost, well, it's in fact worse than what it was towards, you know, it's almost the same as where it was, you know, during the COVID crisis. Now, this year has fallen from you know, 18 Rand down to 11 Rand. So I think it might be cheap, but this was not a good set of results.
Wayne McCurry, thank you. From Wealth and Investments at First National Bank this evening, Wayne McCurry, regular Tuesday evening market commentator. We'll catch up with Ed Williamson. He is the chief executive at Old Mutual on those not very good results. Plus Peter Hain coming up in the next half hour.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
I used to start interviews about digital transformation in banking, asking questions like, when last did you go into a bank branch? And then people would respond, go, oh, last week, 6 months ago. But it's no longer even that. It's no longer even that. It's actually, when last did you log onto your internet banking platform on your computer? It's perhaps a better question, because I don't know when last I did that. It's pretty old school. Talk about that in just a second. On the next Money Show, Richard Rivett-Carnac. He is the boss of SAB, South African Breweries in South Africa, part of the mighty global AB InBev. Richard is our shapeshifter this week. I'm looking forward to catching up with him. Our consumer ninja, Wendy Nola, with your consumer rights, and Colin Cullis with Business Unusual, your Wednesday evening regulars on the Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
So when last did you log on to your internet banking platform? Mouse, keyboard, click, 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 navigate. Nowadays, it's just touch and button on your phone. It's a digital app and you're into digital banking world. The world of banking is changing very, very dramatically. And research has been done recently by Boston Consulting in South Africa. Managing Director and Partner is Dr. Thaisbert Kremers-Chatavadi. And Thaisbert, good evening. Welcome to the Money Show this evening. 25 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, Bill Gates said, banking is necessary, banks are not. And we're getting closer and closer and closer to that reality, I suspect.
Well, good evening, Bruce. Well, I think sort of our research doesn't say that that banks are no longer necessary. We come to the conclusion that South Africans sort of have a high preference and an increasing preference to do business via mobile or internet channels, so digital channels. And actually, sort of the research also shows that that is true across income categories and age categories. I wouldn't say that necessarily means that as a consequence, sort of banks are no longer necessary, because much of the interaction and also the products that that we as consumers like to obtain from them are still necessary, like loans and payments alike.
Okay, well, maybe bank branches perhaps aren't necessary. Bricks and mortar aren't necessary. Yes, for many people they are. I mean, Capitec is expanding its branch network, but the large commercial banks are actually cutting back, and cutting back quite aggressively and successfully in terms of driving digital transformation in the way in which their clients behave.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what you see, is that consumers see that the need for branches is decreasing. And about 60% of consumers actually says that in 5 years from now, they could see a world where there are no longer branches. That also means that there is, on the other hand, another 40% that still sees a necessity. And across the two categories, you still see that consumers do appreciate in-person contact. That doesn't necessarily have to be branch-based, but they do see a need for in-person contact, especially when they have sort of more complex needs where they need advice and they feel that only digital interaction possibly is not enough, and they want an augmentation of the interaction with a human interface.
I suppose one of the great issues with South Africa's massive inequality crisis, of course, is the lack of access to digital channels, and even, you know, in terms of the devices and perhaps even the education needed to make the tech work effectively. The branches are still a critical lifeline for many millions of South Africans who are just massively underprivileged and can't access the sort of stuff that we're talking about this evening.
Yeah, on the one hand, that's true. On the other hand, sort of, you also see that sort of, especially at the bottom of society, many people today are not yet financially included. So also in the current models, they don't really have access to bank branches. And as I said, I think the question is also in the medium term, whether that interaction that is more human-based needs to be branch-based or can be based on digital interaction models or agency banking, or where there is more mobile agent as a model rather than branch-based. So the question that you asked previously, is it bricks and mortar? We believe that necessity is decreasing over time, and that's actually what consumers are telling us.
I mean, unless you keep money at home in the sofa or keep money in the cupboard or whatever the case is, we also dream about a cashless future. The regulators, I think, would like a cashless future. Digital transactions are easier to trace. It's much easier to follow money around the financial system when it is digitized. I would think regulators would love us to go cashless. Do we want to go cashless in the same way as the regulators would like to see it happen?
I think sort of the advantages of cashless also for ourselves are quite big, because it's easier. You eradicate the need to go to an ATM, and so the chance that you're out of banknotes. At the same time, today, and this is also how regulators, I think, look at it, is sort of you have to balance that with sort of the functionality that cash still offers, because you referred to, for instance, financial inclusion. At this moment, we don't have a full penetration yet of South Africans with banking products, and therefore we still rely on cash. And also you see that some of the peer-to-peer payment models sort of are not as well developed yet. So it still requires innovation to actually deliver sort of the full functionality in a cashless society. Yeah? So I think we're not ready for that. And that's also what you see. And many South Africans actually go multiple times per month to an ATM to withdraw cash, driven by a need that you can't do everything digital yet that you would like in a payment sense.
Dr. Tesbert Kremers, he is with Boston Consulting Group in South Africa, and that's expensive. Banks increasingly dissuading us through charging us more to withdraw from their own ATMs. It becomes very, very expensive. People are wising up and drawing money from grocery stores and things like that. But yeah, the cost of cash is rising and rising dramatically.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
To Peter Hain, now Lord Peter Hain, British politician, anti-apartheid campaigner, as part of the faculty at Gibbs, of course, as well. He's in South Africa. And two of the best days in ages, Lord Peter Hain, when it comes to the pushback against corruption. Yesterday, the appearance of several people, including Brian Molefe and Anoj Singh of Transnet and Eskom fame. And today, Jacob Zuma's ordered to pay back another a wodge of money. Well, goodness knows how far these cases go, but the pushback finally seems to be happening.
Yes, it's encouraging. The wheels of justice move very, very slowly, in fact, frustratingly so, for most South Africans who want to see the people who committed these terrible looting and corruption in orange overalls. But at least it's happening. And that's to South Africa's credit, because in a lot of countries, this doesn't happen. It's far too lengthy, it's far too slow, it's subject to all sorts of obstruction, including elements still in the system that want to go back to the days of widespread looting and are still in position to try and roll the dice back. But nevertheless, it is happening, and I'm encouraged.
States that want to be part of the global economy need to be seen to be acting, and to be acting with purpose, and to be acting very precisely when it comes to fighting white-collar crime, particularly corruption, on the scale that we've seen in South Africa, considering the damage it's done. The state will need some very, very quick and strong and high-profile wins, Peter Hain, in order to be seen to be doing the right thing.
Bruce, yes, and it's got to do with determination, and whether it's the National Prosecuting Authority or the Hawks, or whether it's at a higher level of government, the Justice Ministry and so on. This must be seen to be a relentless purge of the remaining, and they're still considerable, agents of corruption and cronyism seeking to enrich themselves within the system. It's got to be relentless, because until that is the case, you will not attract the foreign investment and confidence that you need. And I've always made it clear that although my job that I took on willingly when Pravin Gordhan and others asked me to do it in 2017, that the good elements within the ANC in the last dog days of the Zuma administration to expose the international dimension to their global corruption, because they were global corporates, and we know who they are, including most recently feeling the Payne Baden company. But they needed to feel the heat, because it always took two to tangle. It was not just corrupt politicians led from Zuma all the way down, led by Zuma all the way down, but it was businesses playing their game, paying the bribes, taking the fees, and making the looting possible, including the international banks such as HSBC and Standard Chartered and Bank of Baroda in the main. And those banks have never really apologized or opened their digital footprints to, you were mentioning, you know, connection with mobile banking earlier on, but opening their digital footprints to try and trace the money. So I think there's still a lot of work needed, but at least there's progress, and that's to be applauded.
We've got a story breaking this evening on Daily Maverick. We just spoke to Poli van Wyk about Sasfin and its alleged complicity in helping launder 3 billion rand out of South Africa during 2017. And the company sort of claiming this evening that it's only just become aware of it and it's collaborating and cooperating. There just seems that, you know, there has been far too much either an insufficient, rigorous interrogation of client activities, that's being generous, or an active participation in the problem here, Peter Hain. And, I mean, this is stuff that runs far deeper, I suspect, than, you know, any commission of an inquiry like the Zondo inquiry could actually ever get to the bottom of.
I think you're absolutely right, and I'm sure that is the case, that this latest revelation, have we only seen the tip of the iceberg now? Because the prodigious looting and money laundering in South Africa, which robbed the country of, some economists estimate, a fifth of your GDP, yeah, a fifth of national wealth, that is massive. And hit economic confidence and hit growth and therefore hit jobs. And how these people in the politicians purport to be representing the poor and representing the dispossessed when they have robbed them, quite literally. But this latest revelation, which I look forward to reading in the Daily Maverick, and journalists like Paul van Wyk and Peter Louis Myberg and others have been absolutely relentless and showed great courage and determination in the face of massive intimidation and threats, including from, you know, the EFF and others. You know, one of the things that encourages me about South Africa, amidst all the gloom, is that you have a vigorous, independent, investigative media that exposes corruption and wrongdoing, and this is an example. And these international corporates have got to feel the pain. This latest excuse, as you reported, now I'm not seeing the details, that they're saying, they didn't know. That's their usual excuse, Bruce. They usually say, oh, well, we weren't sure. We will now try to rectify it, but the horse is bolted.
Peter Hain, thank you very much indeed. Lord Peter Hain, who is in the House of Lords in the UK, been instrumental in helping to, of course, unpick the battle against corruption. On to Ian Williamson now, Old Mutual Group Chief Executive, declared an interim dividend today. First set of results, it says, not defined by the impacts of COVID-19, but the result's not good. We've seen current client cash flow down 30%. We've seen the NAV of new business, the new business flows down 4%. It's been a really tough 6 months, Ian Williamson, despite the fact that we have seen the worst effects of COVID now boxed and put behind us. It's been a tough 6 months for you.
Hi, Bruce. Yeah, sure. The operating environment certainly was tough. However, I'm not sure you're interpreting the numbers correctly. 15% up for new business life sales, 10% up on our short-term insurance sales, margins maintained, and, you know, and 87% up on our operating profit result. So I think I was certainly very happy with the result. The net client cash flow was down slightly, as you rightly say. It was a minus 4 billion for the period. That was all low-margin institutional asset management money that we lost. So we had a net neutral revenue impact in our asset manager from our various inflows and outflows, despite the outflows going up. So I was pretty comfortable with the results. I thought in the operating environment they were pretty good.
Market didn't like them. Market pushed the share price down 10%. But look, it's a one-day move. We'll see what happens after this. But your premises and those of Seven Rivals raided last week in an investigation into alleged collusion on the pricing of products over this competition authority selling us decades. Can you categorically deny the assertion by the Competition Commission that you've participated in activities that would be considered to be anti-competitive, anti-customer?
I think, Bruce, at this stage, we need to be clear that there had been no concrete assertions made, certainly no concrete allegations put to us. The Commission did raid, and we were all very surprised when they did raid last Thursday. Certainly we were very surprised. The nature of what panned out during that raid, as they call it, was that they were seeking certain evidence from very specific parts of our departments, if you like, in our organisation. I think what I will say is that, you know, Old Mutual, I think we believe stands for good corporate governance and good standards. We do not have any appetite for anybody breaching the laws of our country, and we also do not have any appetite for anyone behaving in a way that ends up being prejudicial to our customers.
So, is it possible that with all of the checks and balances, with all of the procedures, all of the processes that you have, that there could be a cabal of people within the insurance industry who somehow secretly operate in the nether regions of 7 or 8 or 5 or 6 insurance companies and have done so for decades, sharing information on pricing? To my mind, it seems a stretch. But is it possible? Is it even vaguely feasible? Or is the competition authority tilting at a windmill that really doesn't exist?
Now, look, I agree with you. It's difficult to see, how that could end up being an outcome. But as I say, let's allow the process to unfold. We would be guessing somewhat. I think it's, as you say, decades-long. We know that this is an incredibly competitive business where brokers compare prices on a daily basis across the various players. The margins are thin, and I would like to suggest that, you know, on the basis of the financial outcomes we've seen over the last few years, a fiercely competitive business where, you know, profits have been a bit scarce thanks to COVID partly, but also because it's not possible to price in a way that compensates for those kind of things because of the competitive nature of the industry.
Ian Williamson, Chief Executive at Old Mutual.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
This is The Money Show. It is 7 minutes past 7 on this Tuesday evening. The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Well, what a fascinating first hour we had of the show this evening. Pody van Wyk at Daily Maverick with a massive expose on money that was allegedly funneled through Sasfin's accounts in 2017. The bank professing its innocence and suspending only last week once a report came out from SARS into alleged collusion within the bank. Two staff members. We wait for more detail on that story. One feels that there may be some distance still to run on that particular one. Jacob Zuma has been ordered to pay back money that he borrowed from VBS Mutual Bank at incredibly advantageous terms for an older gentleman at the end of his career with no visible signs of external support. Then he stopped paying his monthly installments and they've come back and said, no, it's time to pay back the money. And also this evening, we have fascinating insight from Ian Williamson saying it's highly unlikely that there has been any collusion within the insurance industry, certainly not from an Old Mutual perspective, as Old Mutual, of course, is one of the life insurance companies that was raided last week by Competition Commission authorities, claiming, and they've claimed in public, not made the assertions directly to the insurance companies themselves, but have claimed in public that there has been collusion over decades between insurance companies. Now, if brokers are comparing their price sheets, independent brokers or brokers working directly for the organization, is that collusion? Doesn't affect the price of the product, I don't think. I don't know what will be interpreted to be collusion or collusive practices. And if you are somebody who sells as an independent insurance products on behalf of two or three, or your practice sells four companies different insurance products, you are going to be able to compare the prices. You are going to know the ups and downs, the ins and outs, the nooks and crannies of the insurance products. Does that make you part of a collusion on price, or does that make you actually more competitive because you're offering the products of four or five different people? I don't know the answer to these very complex questions, but looking forward to also getting some greater clarity, that's the word we're looking for, on this Tuesday evening.
The Money Show ad feature.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bravery to imagine, the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. To Brendan Seary now. Brendan Seary is an expert on advertising to the extent that he is the Orchids and Onions columnist with Biz Community. You've been writing and talking about advertising for an awfully long time. What's your sense of the advertising, the standard of advertising generally, Brendan, in terms of the South African industry and its long and proud history of enormous creativity?
I think good evening, Bruce. Sorry, I think it goes through ups and downs. You get occasional moments when you're reminded that there is some incredibly talented people in this country, but then there's some really what I would call pedestrian work out there. And then I think one of the biggest problems that we have as an industry and as a country is that many of the global brands use global advertising. So you will see often lots of clean white people in a European city in an advert aimed at South Africa. So that's the kind of problem. I think it's a pity that our agencies don't get more work and our production companies don't get more work, because we've got some really talented people here.
Is that not coming back a little bit? I mean, certainly I was talking to somebody today in the entertainment industry, and they were telling me that there is just this sudden upsurge of activity in television production, commercial production, that things have come back with a vengeance.
Well, I think that is the case. One hopes it so. There is quite a bit of new work around at the moment, which is showing, you know, not just fresh ideas, but also really, really good execution in terms of production values. And I think that's really, really encouraging to think that we have always, this country's punched well above its weight when it comes to advertising creativity. And let's hope it's coming back. Of course, you know, it depends a lot on how much brands are prepared to spend. And I mean, with you'll know better than I do about there's a lot of risk-averse business people out there who, and that permeates through to advertising. People are not prepared to take a chance like they were perhaps in the 90s, where the ad industry in this country was a bit like the country itself, a bit of a frontiers.
It was wild, yes.
It was wild. It's what I talk about when you remember the BMW beats the Benz ad,
yeah,
which is one of the ones I mentioned in Orchids and Onions this week. They deliberately did that to have a go at Mercedes-Benz, and they booked it to run over the weekend when Mercedes couldn't go and run to the advertising authorities and complain. And then they withdrew it on the Monday. But it had made its point, and it's amazing for an ad which ran for such a short period. People still talk about it now.
Absolutely. And BMW still, you know, boxes, you know, you talk about boxing above your weight, and the motor brands in South Africa have had great domestic advertising campaigns. They've used some of the global stuff, but they've also had some very, very good local stuff as well. And your hero this week, you would call it the Orchid, goes to BMW.
Yeah, I think their latest ad is exactly what we've been talking about, produced locally. And it's a new direction for BMW in a way, because for many, many years, they never featured black people in their advertising. And it was a big problem. People saying, what's wrong? Don't you sell cars to black people? And they would respond in their typical stiff upper lip German way that, no, we don't patronize anybody. And it's about the cars. It's not about people or races. But the reality is that the world has changed. The market has changed. And this new ad, which also goes hand in glove with other campaigns, and they've talk about Generation Joy. And it's very much aimed at young, upwardly mobile people of all colors, but mainly black. And I think that's an interesting kind of switch of a move for BMW, acknowledging that the passion for their brand is, it knows no race, but it's particularly strong among the black community.
And you, if you don't see yourself in a car, you're not necessarily going to associate with it. I mean, and that's, I think, the power of advertising, because the associations are so powerful. And the ad itself, I mean, what is the execution? What does it tell us about the brand and about the what it stands for?
It tells you that it's very vibey, it's very energetic, it's colorful. It's tapped right into the latest kind of fashions and trends. And I think that's what your brand needs to say. If you're going for that aspirational market, you need to kind of say, listen, our products are cutting edge, but so is our advertising. And we know we're out there. These are the fashionable people. These are the kind of the influencers, as much as I hate that word, and sometimes as well. These are the influencers. And I think that they managed to hit right across, including, you know, interestingly, to a shot of a guy with a man bun wearing what very much looks like a dress and high heels. So, I mean, that's out there for a brand like BMW. Heaven knows what the bosses in Germany think about it, because they still all wear grey suits, white shirts and ties to work.
Yeah, but their customers don't. And finally, they're waking up to that reality. And less of a wonderful execution is out of a particular branch of a Toyota franchise in South Africa.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I'm a bit of a stickler for grammar, and people say, well, why are you being like, because you're a bit anally retentive. But the reality is this particular ad, which was done for Rand Stadium Toyota, which is a Toyota franchise, and the ad was not from Toyota, or, you know, whose ad agency, FCB Joburg, would have never let that out of the door. But so these guys throw together their own social media ads, put it out on Facebook, and it says it's a teaser ad for the new Corolla Cross Gazoo racing version. So Toyota has a tarted up brand which goes racing, and they call it Gazoo Racing. So they've done the business on the new Corolla Cross. But Rand Stadium Toyota chooses to advertise it by saying there's a new GN coming, and it bears a cross. But bears was spelled B-A-R-E-S. And I thought, well, what are you trying to say? Are you saying that there's a cross hidden inside it? What, and it bears a cross? Or did you perhaps spell bears, B-E-A-R-S, wrong? But it's also bizarre because, you know, we all know that bearing a cross relates to the crucifixion and Calvary. So what is the point? If you're bearing a cross, it means you're bearing a burden. So whoever wrote that ad, and it may well be, you know, someone from the mechanical department, the way it's written, has no kind of clue about how to use language in it. And one of the things you shouldn't do with advertising is send messages which are not instantly understandable.
Absolutely not, Brendan Seri. What a joy to have you on. Thank you very much indeed. BMW's Generation Joy advert getting absolute orchid status, or in our language, the hero status, the zero to Rand Stadium Toyota. What a mess that was. Bears a cross. Not bearing a grudge, is Brendan Seri, but certainly saying that's a big fat zero. Sorry, sorry, Rand Stadium Toyota. If you're going to do it, wonderful. Congratulations on your attempts at saving money. But if you are going to save the money, send it to a teacher or someone just to help.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
The Africa Business Focus brought to you by South African Airways. And Diana Games is the chief executive at the business consultancy Africa at Work. And let's get to Nigeria first. The growth rates in Nigeria, how are things panning out? Above, below expectations? What's happening to growth in the biggest economy in Africa?
Well, what we've seen, Bruce, is the release of the second quarter growth figures in Nigeria, showing that it's on a reasonable growth trajectory of 3.54% in the second quarter, which is higher than the first, slightly higher than the first quarter. And it is above the market forecasts, which were originally below 3%. Nigeria has been having a tough time. I think the biggest problem it's facing at the moment, apart from the insecurity in some areas, is a huge forex crunch. It's nothing new in Nigeria. It's hugely dependent on oil production to for foreign exchange revenues. And what's happened is that there's a large amount of kind of theft and pipeline vandalism, which means oil production is well below target and much lower than it should be. So as a result, obviously the revenues coming in are also lower than they should be. So we're just seeing there's a lot of problems. People cannot get imports into the country. It's even becoming difficult to travel. I see your shows sponsored by SAA. You know, of course, they will be affected. Apparently, the government sent, or the central bank owes $464 million to airlines in ticket sales inside the country that it can't repatriate because of doesn't have the foreign exchange to do so. It has paid some of it, but it's not enough to stop, for example, Emirates, which is one of the most popular airlines going out of Nigeria, to suspend its flights from next month until it can get its money out. And we've also seen British Airways saying that they will only take fares in hard currency because they can't get the local currency out. So there's a lot of issues around the foreign exchange problem related to the oil problem, etc. But what we have also seen, which is positive in the growth figures, is that the non-oil sector has performed well, as it has been for a long time, strongly led by ICT investment, but there are various other sectors as well. So we'll see how this goes. What we do have coming up in Nigeria, and this is, I guess, a real double-edged sword for Nigeria, as it is for many other African countries, and that is an election. So that is coming up in February, and of course things are already in kind of full swing. There's a lot of people's attention diverted to this political campaign. Well, the campaigns haven't really started yet, but in effect, you know, elections are a very big thing in Nigeria, and so it doesn't take long for this thing to get into full swing. And I think it's a highly contested election as well. There's no obvious winner. I think people are tired of the Buhari administration, saying that Nigeria has not reached its full potential, notwithstanding COVID and oil price crashes. There's a lot of other problems that they've had. So whether this will affect the ruling party, I don't know. One of the other candidates is actually Tiku Abubakar, who's in fact a close friend of former President Jacob Zuma. So that would be interesting to see how things would pan out, was he to win the Nigerian election. So that's still some time away, but it is already a factor in investors thinking, well, should we hold out? Should we wait a bit longer and just see how this thing pans out?
Well, hopefully we get a more decisive outcome than we did in Kenya recently. I mean, that was just so close and so narrow. And it doesn't bode, I mean, it's wonderful for democracy in theory, but it doesn't bode well for stability when you've got half the country absolutely livid and the other half, you know, in raptures of joy that their candidate has won. You don't get sort of a sense of conclusive support for a candidate.
I know, and I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I was actually an election monitor in the Kenyan elections, and people were seemed very, very dedicated to making this election as free and fair as possible. I mean, you just really felt it wherever you went. People were really doing their jobs very thoroughly, etc. But in fact, the interesting thing is that it seems like a lot of the if there was skullduggery, which is not yet proven, it was in the whole technology side, where everybody thought that actually it was technology that would save the Kenyan and other elections from rigging. But it seems that that was one of the enablers. But, you know, the jury is still out, so we'll see how that goes. But I agree with you. If you know that just about half the country is in favor of one party and not the winning party, it definitely affects the kind of the sense of moving forward at the end of an election.
Talk to me then about, we'll stay with Nigeria, just look at the advertising regulator. And it's a weird story here in terms of the use of foreign models in adverts and the sort of real protectionism and, dare I say, xenophobia toward in the advertising industry.
Well, it's not the first sort of move in this direction. What has happened just recently, and it's caused quite a stir on social media and comment, because people are still not quite sure how they feel about it, people outside Nigeria and even inside. The regulator has banned the use of foreign models in adverts that are being flighted locally on television, etc. The reason for this is that it wants to develop local talent. I think a lot of African governments are aware of a lot of young people without work, without opportunity. And this is one of the areas where they feel they can really develop the youth market, is in advertising and in the sort of media world. And there already is a ban in place on foreign voiceovers in television adverts in Nigeria. So this is another step. And there was already also, you would have to pay like a penalty of about $240 for every foreign model used in an advertising spot before this ban came into play. And a lot of commentators have said, look, that had already, that was a response to Nigerians saying, you know, there's 200 million of us. How can we not find people who are Nigerian to advertise goods in Nigeria? And I think it'd be interesting to talk to an advertising sort of expert about this, to say, you know, I think a lot of companies, Nigeria is home to a lot of like British multinationals in particular, that they have campaigns that roll across regions, for example, rather than countries. And I don't know how that's going to play out. They do say that they can continue with the current campaigns that are ongoing. But so I think it will certainly drive empowerment. But, is it too blunt an instrument? You know, there's a lot of South Africans who are in adverts that are flighted in Nigeria. And also you get a lot of people in the diaspora, you know, with British accents. That's quite an aspirational thing in advertising, because Nigerians really like imported goods and they see that as being something that is aspirational. So perhaps that's been a reason for it. Although, of course, they have a very large Nigerian diaspora with a British and American accents as a consequence of people being educated abroad. So it's early days. I think we need to see how this plays out. But there's certainly, I've seen on social media myself, that there's been quite a lot of support for, let's do this. I mean, South Africa would probably lend itself to something like this. But saying, you know, we need more Africans to be, it's part of a kind of rising, I don't know if nationalism is the right word, but a kind of let Africa be for Africans, part of that kind of sentiment, which is growing across Africa. And perhaps this is going to be well received and replicated in other countries. So it'd be interesting to see.
Watch that space. And then Zimbabwe, in what was 2020, suspended both PPC and Old Mutual. Old Mutual's been in Zimbabwe almost as long as it's been in South Africa. It's been, it goes back probably more than a century. They were both suspended from the Zim Stock Exchange. Is there any prospect of them ever getting back? Do they care? One would think from a local perspective they would, but what is the position?
Well, what happened, Bruce? In 2020, they were banned because, you know, as with everything to do with Zimbabwe, it was a complicated story where at the time the black market rate for the currency was moving really rapidly. And I think the government was casting around for scapegoats. And these dual listed stocks on the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange were targeted. And that would be Old Mutual, PPC. And I think another was Seedco, which is a large Zimbabwe company. And at the time, they were accused of fueling speculation. Well, not they, but the fact of their dual listing enabled speculation on the black market rate, which the government said was pushing the rate into the ground. And so they suspended these companies. But there seemed to be another reason that they suspended them, not just about this whole speculative issue, but also because they were about to launch what people called a vanity project of a sort, the Victoria Falls Stock Exchange, which was launched in October 2020, just soon after these suspensions. And this is a purely US dollar denominated exchange. And the idea, I think, was that these PPC and All Mutual Zimbabwe would automatically graduate to this exchange. But that actually did not happen. Seedco listed, and in fact, as we speak, there's only four listings, and two of them are mining companies, Seedco, another Zimbabwe company, Padinga. So they haven't seen the success of that as they'd hoped. So now I think they're looking again at these suspensions of Old Mutual Zimbabwe and PPC. And the head of the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange said, no, well, there's a big announcement due soon, but he wouldn't say what that is. But it does, you know, he said they were embarrassed that it's taken so long to resolve this problem. I mean, I don't really know what that means. But what he also said, interestingly, is there's been no foreign exchange, no foreign direct investment or foreign currency moving onto the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange since 2015, which really shows you that I think the size of the risk of that market. People are worried about putting their money in, but particularly about getting their money out, because there's so many different exchange rates. And you know, I think you might have heard already that they've now producing these gold coins as some kind of tender in Zimbabwe. I'm not sure of all the details around that, but it's designed to stop the currency in free fall and rein in inflation.
You can't muck about with pet projects and expect that to make a fundamental difference. If you restructure your economy, do it properly, go back to basics. But thank you very much, Diana Games, Chief Executive at the business consultancy Africa at Work. I forgot to play Tricky Tuesday. I had a fabulous Tricky Tuesday for you today. The Tricky Tuesday number is 92. 92. It's a birthday. That's all I will give you. You've got 5 minutes. 92. A birthday. That's your quiz. It's not really a quiz. It's a fun game. 072-702-1702. That is the WhatsApp number this evening if you want to play Tricky Tuesday. 92. It's a birthday. Whose?
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to imagine and the will to get things done. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
Our investment school this evening headmaster is Pietri Redlinghuis, the founder at Arenia Capital Advisors. I was going to throw this question to you, Pietri, but I'm not going to do it now because James has given us a call this evening and James wants to participate today's Tricky Tuesday number. It was remiss of me not to throw it out a little earlier, but I said to you the number is 92, James in Sandton. To what does the number 92 refer?
That will be referring to Warren Buffett's birthday today.
It is, and he's 92 years old. He's a bullet, and he works every day and continues to work. And by the best assessments I can make, Charlie Munger, you know, certainly not every day at the office, but still very, very active in the business of Berkshire Hathaway. It's astonishing, isn't it?
It is indeed. It's indeed. 92 years is fantastic.
Now, if you had that much money, would you still be working at 92? Especially, it's not work for him, is it?
Probably not working now.
James and Santon, thank you very much indeed. Yeah, indeed, Warren Buffett's birthday. 92 years young. He's an astonishing individual. And his investment track record is equally astonishing. And he has made a vast fortune in a single lifetime, of which he's going to be giving most away through his friend Bill Gates and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. See Bill Gates on LinkedIn this evening is posting, life is more fun when you have a friend like Warren. Happy 92nd birthday. And they're like two kids. I mean, Bill Gates is, what, 65-ish? At least-ish? Producers? Google-ish? He's drinking a Coke. Warren Buffett's drinking what looks like a strawberry milkshake with cream on top and sprinkles, or those could be marshmallows. I mean, the guy should be dead based on his diet. I watched him, Omaha, Nebraska, sitting on stage in the massive basketball stadium in Omaha. And he's an investor in Coke, so he drinks Coke, and he drinks several Cokes in the session. Maybe those are the only Coca-Colas he drinks during the year, but I doubt it. He seems to be a kid. He seems to be a 92-year-old with a 10-year-old's sugar habits. And then, yeah, just lovely pictures of Bill Gates and Warren Buffett mucking about together, playing table tennis and fancy dress and all sorts of things. But yeah, Warren Buffett keeping Bill Gates young, it would seem. Happy birthday to Warren Buffett, 92 years young today.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
You would have got that right, Pietri, surely.
To be honest with you, I probably wouldn't have.
Well, I'm delighted I didn't embarrass you. Let's do it now. So, Pietri, everybody makes bad investment decisions. Warren Buffett made bad investment decisions. He invested in, I forget what they were, but in banks and in airlines and all sorts of things. He's made mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. But like anything in life, it's not about how you go in. It's about how you come out. It's about how you recover, then how you proceed, and whether or not you repeat the same mistakes over and over again as to whether you're an idiot or whether you become successful. So you're giving us some tips this evening on how to recover from bad investments or making a loss in the stock market, because it is something that can get one down, I suspect.
Yeah, I mean, it's also one of those inescapable realities of being involved in markets. I think before we start with that, though, just on the Warren Buffett topic a little bit, there's a great book by a gentleman called Benjamin Graham that was written many, many years ago. It is called The Intelligent Investor. Now, for context, Benjamin Graham was Warren Buffett's mentor and taught Warren Buffett much of what he knows about his approach to investing. So if you are keen on learning the Buffett way, I would highly recommend that book, The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham.
I forget what year exactly it was written, but it was written in the 1920s. And the lessons of investing are eternal lessons of investing. And it's a book still in print. You can, I don't know if you can get it on Takealot, but certainly you can get it on Amazon when last I checked.
They're a bit pricey, and it's a monster. It's a 900-page book. It's not, it's no joke. You need to put a pencil to underline.
But is it for, it's not your first investing book. It's not the sort of book you go to, like, I want to learn to invest, I'm going to read Benjamin Graham. I think it's quite higher grade, isn't it?
It is quite high grade. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I took it on early in my career, and I highlighted and underlined things and Googled like a madman because half the stuff I didn't understand. But going through that process was hugely beneficial. And, you know, you learn a lot. And often when you read things that are very complex, and you don't understand what they're talking about, it forces you to learn to dig deeper. You know, if they're talking about EBITDA and you don't really know what that is, so you Google it. Okay, there's a new concept. And then in the very next sentence, you know, there's another new concept that you have to learn. So it takes a mighty long time, but it is fascinating. And if you have the patience and the, I guess, persistence to work your way through that book, it's definitely worth it. But let's be honest, you know, if you want to be a professional long-term investor, you can't play in the beginner pool all the time.
Absolutely. The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham, it's in its umpteenth edition. There's a revised edition available on Takealot. It's on 42% off. So it's on Opslach at 285 Rand. So you can get it locally. It can get ordered to you. I'm told this, like, I received recently, and apparently he's not doing interviews anymore, which really upsets me, but Morgan Housel's The Psychology of Money. It's been out for a while as well. I don't know if you've read that one, but that one, I'm told, is the ultimate beginner's guide. Because if you want to understand the emotions of money and you understand why people do stupid things with money, why we all do stupid things with money, Morgan Housel's The Psychology of Money is a good starting point. Would you concur with that one, Pietri?
I would concur with that indeed. And I think that talks to a little bit of what we're going to be talking about this evening, because a lot of the time, you know, the mistakes we make with investing are born from emotional mistakes that we make, because money is a very emotional thing, right? We are very attached to it. We work very hard for it. And if we lose it, it hurts. And often once we've, you know, had a bit of a losing streak or a couple of bad investments or bad trades or whatever it may be, our need to make the money back drives, fear-based decision-making, which generally tends to make us somewhat reckless. You know, if you've got 100 bucks and you lose 50, all you can think about is making your 50 Rand back. You wouldn't be satisfied with a 5 Rand profit. You want your 50 Rand back. So you continuously take bigger and bigger risks trying to make your 50 bucks back, you know, as quickly as possible. And that often ends in you losing your remaining 50 bucks, right? So the psychology of money is something worth understanding. And I think one of the things that is difficult for investors, and I'm going to group both investors and traders in one category here tonight. One thing that is very difficult for us to get over is that, you know, sometimes we lose and you can't make all your money back in one transaction or one investment after you've made a loss, right? So if you've taken a series of losses, rather than desperately trying to get your money back, what you should be doing is, you know, just refocusing on your process and trying to make just small, consistent gains. That's really how you make money over time. You know, it's very flashy and interesting and exciting to be a trader and to be actively involved in the market. But the reality is often the money's made over the long term. And we're heading into a period where markets have been very tough for the last sort of maybe 2.5 years now, and particularly over the last 6 months or 8 months. And I think they're going to get a lot more tough over the next 12 to 18 months. So learning to be a good loser, I think, is a very important lesson to learn before we go into this period.
We're not encouraging losing. Losing is not the preferred strategy, but the point is you are going to win and you are going to lose. And it's about learning from your losses and not getting too overconfident with your wins. I suppose they're two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, I guess that's also kind of the first point, right? Is we do make poor investments from time to time or poor decisions. And the
sometimes you just get screwed over. I mean, you could have quite legitimately smart people made investments in Steinhoff. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I think when these things happen to us, the first thing that we have to do is kind of extract the lesson that we can from, you know, whatever it was that had taken place. Like, for example, I don't know, maybe Steinhoff is a poor example, but if you make an investment that doesn't work out, you can sit back and analyze, well, what went wrong? What did I miss? What did I not see? You know, I bought these hotel stocks because they were down 20% during the beginning of the pandemic. You know, in retrospect, well, maybe my time horizon was a bit short. I bought them because they'd come down a lot. Is that a good enough reason to buy a stock? Should I not be considering what potentially could happen over the next 12 to 24 months? Should I not be more future orientated with my investment decisions? So these are, you know, and often it's nice to, you learn some from winning, but you learn most from losing, right? I mean, if you put your hand on the hot plate and you burn your fingers, you're going to learn a lot faster to not do that again than if the stove is off all the time, right?
Okay. We don't want to burn our fingers though. This is what we don't want to do. I suppose once you've lost money, you've got to decide whether or not you keep, whether you were right and the market is wrong, because sometimes the market is wrong. It's not always you. It's not always the company that's wrong. Sometimes the market gets it wrong, which is how Buffett made his money. Market underpriced great value shares, and so he bought them when they were massively undervalued. Sometimes it is possible to recover your money, and I suppose you've got to be able to make that call as to whether or not this is one of those cases.
Well, I think, you know, my mindset is a bit different to that. My mindset is that the market is always right, and we are the ones that make mistakes, right? And yes, you're right. Sometimes the market does misprice an asset or a share or a company or overlook it, and the opportunity, you know, presents itself for that company's share price to re-rate and come back to its true intrinsic value. But, you know, to an extent, we also have to accept that the market is driven by individuals who make decisions based on what they think is cheap or expensive and are driven by, you know, emotional motivations most of the time. So in some cases, yes, the market can get it wrong, but 99% of the time it's going to be you that gets it wrong, right? Something that you missed out on. I think one of the things that we can do, and this is something that's, you know, very important for the short-term traders, but can be quite helpful for longer term investors as well, is to document your process. When you take a trade or make an investment or buy a share in a company or a bond or whatever it is, build almost a playbook for yourself. Write down your thesis. Why am I investing in this company? What do I like about this company? What do I know about this company? What do I know about, you know, what this company's plans are for the future? Document your process that you went through in order to make that investment decision. And then if you are in a losing position or in a winning position, again, document your process. Keep a journal of what you did, what went wrong, what went right, what you didn't see, what news came out that surprised you. And working through that journal is going to be hugely beneficial for you to make better decisions next time around. Because essentially, the most successful investors have a rock solid process. It's not about buying the hot thing or, you know, hitting a luck or whatever the case may be. It's generally a process of sifting through tons of shares, looking for specific things, you know, specific ratios, specific sectors, specific traits that a company must have in order to make it a viable option for you to invest in. And by documenting your process again and again and again over time, you'll start to see which traits are the ones that are actually most successful for you. And everybody has a different process, and everybody has different things that they look for.
Do you think that there are more than 1,000 people in this market, independently of people who are professionals like yourself, who actually sit down and do that on a regular basis? My instinct on this, and I don't know this for a fact, and please, if you are one of those people who's a perfectionist and who likes to analyze in the way that Pietri is suggesting, you'll sit down and journal your decisions. A lot of people go, well, yeah, I like it. It's nice. I like to go there. Well, I buy there, and I see lots of people buying there, and therefore they must make huge profits, so they buy. And they don't go through the agony, because you're a professional and this is your job and you spend many, many hours every day doing it. Regular people don't have the time to go through the process in the way you're describing it. They're doing it on Twitter tips and on Easy Equities hype. And, you know, when their Twitter account is firing, they go, well, hey, everyone else is doing it. I'm going to do it too. Yay. Maybe that's the lesson you learned. Don't do that. But I wonder how much thought we put into it.
Maybe this is a good time to draw that distinction between investors and traders, right? So specifically traders, there was a study done, I think it was in 2018 or 2019 that it was published, where researchers did a statistical study where they tracked something like, if I remember the number exactly, 19,646 traders, right? And they controlled for a number of things. You had to have traded an equal number of contracts a day. So you were specifically a day trader. You didn't hold positions overnight and that type of stuff. And they were tracking the IBA Vespa E-mini future, which is like the third most liquid futures contract in the world, right? Over 300 trading days. So that's what, 2 years? Of, let's round up, 20,000 people that started, 47 were profitable over 300 days. Yeah? So the ones that write in their journals and document their process, I bet you each one of those 47 did that. Everyone else who didn't, thanks for coming.
No, exactly. You've been eaten and carried out feet first. But there's got to be a point also where you can start to overthink things, surely. Just it starts because you get to a point where it's like, hold on a second, stop navel-gazing, make a decision. And make a decision based on your journals and everything else and your interrogation and your thinking and your analyzing. But for goodness sake, you know, either pee or get off the pot.
Yeah. So analysis paralysis is a saying, particularly for technical traders, where you look at every angle five different times and you analyze so much, you never actually make a decision, right? Particularly if we find ourselves in a bad investment or a bad trade that's not working and we're losing money on it, then we're also taught, and this is human behavior, we're taught from an early age that being wrong is wrong. So particularly if you've spent the last 2 weeks digging into a company and deciding I'm investing, you know, in this stock, and 6 months later the stock is down, and another 6 months later the stock is down, and you keep analyzing and you just keep finding reasons to own it, and it just keeps going down, it becomes very difficult for us to accept that we're wrong, right? So you have to have a way to limit your losses. You have to have a predetermined point where you say, if this share is down 30% from when I buy it, and we're assuming you're an investor here and not a trader, if you buy a share or a share in a company and it, you know, falls by 30%, then sell it. You can always buy it back later, but you have to have a predetermined level where you decide, I've gotten it wrong. I need to act in my own best interest here, protect my capital, and walk away. You don't want to sit there and analyze. I mean, I'm a victim of this. I've done this many times, where you've done so much research and you have such a clear idea of what you think should happen, but it's just not happening. Maybe you're early, maybe you're completely wrong. The point is, right now you're losing money and your capital could be invested elsewhere and generating you a return. So you must have a predetermined level where you say, if I buy the share at 100 Rand and it falls to 70, I am out. If there is some sort of a fundamental catalyst or a change that happens in future and the share price goes up again, and there's another compelling reason for me to buy different to the reason I bought it in the first place, then sure, I can buy it back. But in the meantime, I'm going to take my effort and apply it somewhere else to find a new opportunity and a new investment to get into.
How do you deal with the fact that on the day that you sell your 100 Rand share for 70, it starts going up and within a month is back up to 100? Do you just then buy it back at 100? And then watch it go back down to 70? Because that's what happens.
That happens. That's where this emotional thing comes into play, right? So for me personally, what I find is if I've had a losing, investment or trade or whatever the case is, I tend to take that stock off of my watch list for some time, at least a month afterwards, so that I don't, because there's always that regret of, well, I sold it at 70, it's now back at 80, man, it's going to go back up, and I can almost guarantee you, by the time you buy it at 100 again, it's going to turn around and dump you out at 70 a second time, right? So it's better sometimes to just walk away, give it maybe, if you're an investor again, give it maybe 3 to 6 months and then reconsider it. Rather spend your energy somewhere else, because the stock market is a very big place. I mean, yes, our market is somewhat small, but investors are not limited only to our market. There are hundreds of thousands of different shares available around the world for you to trade in or to invest in, and you can find an opportunity elsewhere. Sometimes, if you've dropped the milk kind of thing, trying to lap it up off the floor isn't really going to be very helpful. Rather, see where you can find another bottle of milk.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you've got to be able to move on. But and that is the secret, I suppose, is that ability to recover from your bad investment. Use what you've learned and move on. Because, you can so easily get wedded to a bad idea.
Yeah, and this is, again, where your journal will become very useful to you, because you can then, once you've decided, all right, it's hit my predetermined sort of loss level, I'm walking away from this, then you can go through your journal. What were the reasons I got into this trade? What were the things I was looking for when I bought this, when I made this investment? What were my expectations? What were the circumstances surrounding this? What in that didn't work? And how can I adapt my process to find the next opportunity? So when you do walk away, rather than, lamenting when the share recovers and you're now left on the side of the road watching, the success story unfold without you, take the lessons from that bad experience and try to take out, the good things that you've done, avoid the bad things, play to your strengths, and find another opportunity. That I think I've said this, something we've spoke about before in the past, is almost every single year there is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Right? 2 years ago, that was Sasol. This year, it might be something else. So every year, the market and the world gives us opportunities that can change our lives forever. And we have to just, our job is to make sure that we are available to take them.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you very much, Pietri. It's been wonderful to have you on. Pietri Redlinghuis, the founder at Herenia Capital Advisors, the 5 things you need to learn from investing. Investment mistakes. Appreciate and accept that you're going to make them. All of the world's greatest investors make mistakes. There are 2 foreign books we spoke about. Morgan Housel's Psychology of Money. I'm going to get my teeth into it soon. It's been on the market for a while. Benjamin Graham, I'm not sure I'm ever going to read Benjamin Graham. It's quite heavy going, but it is available on Takealot. So if you wanted to get into a more meaty discussion and a more meaty thought process, Benjamin Graham, he inspired Warren Buffett, and it worked out okay for Warren. And the principles are universal, even though those principles are 100 and more years old from Benjamin Graham. And then my favorite domestic personal finance book remains Warren Ingram's How to Make Your First Million. Just the stories in it are massively inspiring about what is possible. It's all about money.